Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. During this centennial year of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which assured that women in the United States have a right to vote, SDPB has embarked on a project to tell the history of suffrage in South Dakota. The battle for women's suffrage in the U.S. was complex, controversial, and sometimes built on division instead of solidarity. Today, we welcome Sarah Egge. She's Associate Professor of History at Center College in Kentucky. She's originally from South Dakota, and she's a contributor to the book Equality at the Ballot Box, Votes for Women on the Northern Great Plains. She's also author of the book Women's Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, 1870 to 1920. Professor Egge, welcome. Thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Take me back a little bit and tell me how long you've been interested in this particular area of history as a point of study.
Sure. So I got interested actually as an undergraduate. I took a course on women's history, and what fascinated me most was that there was really nothing in the scholarly record about women's suffrage in the Midwest, in particular among rural Americans. And so that really struck me as an absence. And considering I'm from South Dakota, I grew up with really strong women in my family and just had all these examples of women who fought for what they knew was right. And so I was unconvinced that there was nothing to say about women's suffrage in the Midwest or in rural America. And so that's really where I started. And I continued to pursue that in graduate school, and I've been doing so ever since as a professor.
Yeah, that must have been frustrating in the sense of, you know, why does this not matter to other people? And then also exhilarating in the sense that says, I might be the person to do this. So there's a project laid out in front of me. Let's talk about, I want to go to your chapter in this book, Equality at the Ballot Box, because it's about ethnicity and women's suffrage. And so much of what our national dialogue right now is about systemic racism and the foundations of enslavement and the legacy of that in America and immigration. And we want to look back at history and say that there's people, you know, that we can just get behind as, you know, 100%, you know, pure or good or perfect. And those are the women who got the right to vote. But of course, it's far more complicated than that. Lay the groundwork here for a little bit on what some of this, you know, inclusion and division was about here on the Great Plains.
Yeah, so just as you said, uncovering this history, one of the things that struck me that no one had really talked about extensively was just how important ethnicity was to the fight in on the Great Plains and in the Midwest when it came to women's suffrage. One of the biggest issues was that people were trying to pass amendment campaigns in the late 19th century in this place that also was seeing a tremendous amount of immigration from mainly northern European countries. And if you look around South Dakota today, it reflects this. We have lots of people with German ancestry, Norwegian or Swedish, Danish ancestry, lots of Scandinavian. And so these immigrant groups were really important to understanding then how women were supposed to ask and demand for the right to vote, because one of the interesting things that South Dakota has, and lots of states actually at this time also have this, is a practice that allows foreigners to vote before they become citizens. It's referred to a number of different things, declarant suffrage or alien suffrage. This is, a common practice in the late 19th century that gives the right to vote to people who have declared their intention to become citizens. And at the time, that was after 2 years of living in a particular place or state. And that was before the five-year residency requirement that allowed you to then petition to become a citizen. So for women in South Dakota and lots of states like this, this is really sort of a stark contrast. Here they are. They are native-born citizens with birthright citizenship that's enshrined in the 14th Amendment. And they are looking around them at a sea of these immigrants who are not citizens, and they can vote. And so that's something that I really try to bring out, that in this particular context, immigration and ethnic identity was a critical component to the ways in which then women and these suffragists made their case for why they should have the right to vote.
So do they have to campaign or make their case to different groups in different ways then? Is that sort of like a messaging problem that they have or a challenge?
Oh, it's definitely challenging because on the one hand, there's a growing sense of nativism, not just in South Dakota and other places in the Midwest, but also nationally. It's pretty small in the late 19th century, but it grows quite quickly. And certainly by World War One, that becomes a major issue. But what it requires these suffragists to do, because these are voters, after all, these ethnic groups, they have to reach out to them. And one of the big divides then is between national suffrage leaders, people like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Carrie Chapman Catt, and state and local suffragists. These national leaders really struggle to reach the ethnic voters. They find this to be really a problem. They're not translating materials into native languages of these immigrants. They're struggling to find lecturers. And so it becomes a real problem for them as they're trying to figure out what message. And the other thing, frankly, for these immigrants, a lot of them are not very excited, frankly, about women voting. So it becomes a real obstacle for people living in South Dakota trying to get the right to vote for women. How do you reach a population that the national leaders are increasingly start to write off at the same time knowing that they're voters, right? And then probably the final issue is temperance, which was tied so tightly to women's suffrage. And for a lot of ethnic voters, they did not want women to have the right to vote because they wanted to continue to drink alcohol, which was a major part of their cultural identities.
Mm-hmm. And so that becomes, you know, something that plays out how? I mean, are they sort of blocked from even speaking to these groups? Are they just voting against them? What, you know, how do some of those dynamics unfold?
So I talk about this in my work. What they have to do is be kind of creative. So a lot of the state and local leaders will kind of work alongside, but then kind of go off on their own away from what the national leaders are doing. They'll take their messages to these immigrant communities. And a lot of these immigrant communities are in sort of these ethnic enclaves. They're away from the railroads at this time. They're not necessarily living in the biggest cities or towns in South Dakota. And so they're going to schoolhouses and they're going to churches and they're trying desperately to convince these immigrant neighbors to support the cause. But again, it's really tricky because a lot of these immigrants are wary. They don't believe that these suffragists are going to, at least what they say, that they're going to actually just vote on particular issues and they're going to stay away from temperance. And in part, it's difficult in South Dakota because the state association at the time, especially in the late 19th century, the leadership of the state association was the same as the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or the WCTU. So they might make promises, but the fact that they had this overlapping leadership was, at least for these immigrants, a clear sign that they were going to vote for, as they say, the rum power out. So it gets really complicated for them. Honestly, it really tangles them up into knots until the 20th century when a new group of state leaders emerges, the South Dakota Universal Franchise League, led by a woman named Mary or Mamie Pyle from Huron. And she explicitly has no ties, at least on the surface, to temperance. And that really allows these suffragists to make women's suffrage a single issue.
Yeah. Sometimes I just have to pause a little bit and think about how people are choosing between the right for someone to vote and their right to drink. And it makes you look at contemporary politics again with a fresh look. And I want to talk about that a little bit because, you know, we're still having these conversations today about our leaders and the people we admire from history. And how do you as a historian look back and say, you know, I'm not going to make excuses, you know, for any behavior or but I want to see who these people were in their fullness of the kinds of conversations they had, the kinds of decisions that they made. How do you approach that as a historian?
Yeah, so that's one of the keys to the discipline, frankly. It's the thing that I try to do the most often is to take away my potential biases, my ideas about what they should have done, and really look at why they did what they did. And what that forces me to do is really look at the context. So what were the range of decisions in front of them? And so for a lot of these groups, it does, if you kind of look at it on the surface, you're thinking, you know, these groups just wanted alcohol and they then didn't support women's suffrage. But I think it actually goes deeper than that. For a lot of them, consuming alcohol was central to their ethnic celebrations. On Sundays, for example, lots of Germans in South Dakota and other Midwestern states would get together. They would speak in German. They would go to church and they would hear German. And then they would have a pint or two. And it wasn't necessarily that alcohol was the key, but it was part of an affirmation of who they were. And even though they had left their old country and their families back there, they could at least bring up those memories in really powerful ways. And so for them, then, women's suffrage was part of a broader effort to erase their cultural identities, to force them to assimilate. And one of the things that a lot of immigrants in South Dakota at the time did not want was to lose that ethnic identity. It was really important to a lot of them. And so I think when I look at that now, I can still see that in a lot of the celebrations that South Dakota has even today. A lot of them are built on these ethnic and racial identities.
Yeah. How did all this intersect with Indigenous women and suffrage for them? And we have 2 minutes to talk about that. So give me a little intro there, because obviously we don't have enough time to get fully into it.
Yeah, well, and so one of the things that is unfortunate here is that while there were lots of Indigenous women who did support women's right to vote, and they were certainly part of cultures that afforded women more rights and more power in their particular positions, unfortunately, a lot of suffragists basically discounted Indigenous women and their participation. They saw them as maybe sort of secondary or even sort of on the margins of the group. They would recall them. I've seen them sort of, they're brought up as sort of examples or tokens of, look at these women, they support women's suffrage, but they were never central to the movement. And in part, it's because the national and state leaders didn't see them that way. It's unfortunate that, again, as you said, systems of race and ideas of race perpetuated inequalities even within the suffrage movement.
Sarah Eggie, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate your time and all your scholarship in this area.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
You could read her chapter, Inequality at the Ballot Box, Votes for Women on the Northern Great Plains. She's also author of the book, Women's Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, 1870 to 1920. SDPB's project about the history of women's suffrage in South Dakota will continue throughout 2020. We'll feature profiles of prominent suffragists and delve into the contentious politics between those in favor and those opposed. We'll also feature more influential South Dakota women changing the landscape of our history today. In hour two of In the Moment, we welcome Stephanie Herseth Sandlin today for that conversation. And you can also look for an SDPB TV documentary coming late this summer. It's called Simple Justice, Suffrage in South Dakota. SDPB is partnered in the project with PBS and WGBH in Boston, and their series, The Vote, which looks at the suffrage struggle on a national level. You can find all our suffrage history coverage on our website at sdpb.org/thevotesd.